Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stories on the program today of American industrial design, of fashion, the way they used to do it, and of our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 20th of May today. Great to have you here, everybody. We begin this Tuesday with the political economics, or the economic politics, if you will, of wordplay. The White House opened its doors this morning to executives from some big multinational companies for a gathering devoted to insourcing, which is, as you may rightly surmise, basically the opposite of outsourcing. Companies making investments and expanding here instead of overseas. The White House says it's won $18 billion in domestic investment so far, which means, in context, what exactly? Kate Davidson gets us going.
You might not have heard of the Danish company Novozymes, but if you've ever used Tide or other liquid detergents, you might have used its products. Novozymes is heavy into enzymes and bioinnovations. And according to CEO Peter Nielsen, it's also heavy into U.S. investment.
We've built a large plant in Omaha, Nebraska, which is a good example of taking something back from China and then putting it into the U.S.
The company has a big U.S. market. Nielsen says lower transportation costs offset the higher price of labor here. There are other reasons businesses are reshoring in the U.S. too, like decreased energy costs thanks to the shale boom. International trade consultant Ed Gerwin says companies are rethinking the way they measure costs. It's not just about labor anymore.
You know, what does it cost to be in a country that doesn't have good intellectual property protection? Or what does it cost to be in a country that may not have the kind of rule of law that we do?
Our problem is that the administration seems to be clapping for investment with just one hand.
Sean Donnelly is with the U.S. Council for International Business.
Somehow inward investment is good, and they are absolutely silent on outward investment.
Outsourcing has come to be a dirty word, but in Donnelly's view, outward investment is important, boosting the health of U.S. companies by giving them access to foreign markets. And he says encouraging that makes sense, too. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Data is where it's at, as you know. Who has yours and what they do with it? So with that, news today that Google is going to buy a software company called Divide. They make something called mobile device management technology, tools basically, to let you keep the confidential, sensitive business data that you have on your smartphone separate from the confidential, sensitive personal stuff that's rolling around in there as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Okay, that's my smartphone telling me I've got a Facebook message. That's voicemail. Could be my son's school or a source calling for this story. That's telling me I've got email, maybe a picture for another story. All this stuff, personal, professional, comes flooding into my expensive little smartphone and then just sort of jostles around in there, which could be a problem if any of it goes out again, let's say because of malware or hacking. Tyler Shields is a mobile security expert at Forrester Research.
So think about if you go and download a tic-tac-toe game from the Google Play Store, once you run it on your phone, it grabs all your contacts or grabs all your calendars.
Not only my contacts and calendars, but my employers too. Maybe also their blueprints and business plans. What Divide software provides is a firewall to separate and protect the business stuff from the personal stuff. Tech analyst Crawford Delpret at IDC.
This move by Google is to say, we are hardening the Android experience. We are going to give you more control to have a secure container and a secure place for your corporate data.
Delpret says Google needs to do this because there's a perception in the marketplace that competing devices and apps from Apple are more secure. This won't necessarily make our personal data much safer, but it might make our bosses stop telling us we have to get one particular brand of smartphone just because somebody in IT says it's the only one that's compatible with our company's security software. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Anybody else think Mitchell's got too many ringtones on his phone? Anybody? Come on now. On Wall Street today, let's just say it wasn't as bad as it could have been, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our series, I've Always Wondered, has a pretty basic premise. You guys ask questions, our reporters answer them.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes from John Kaufman. He's a listener to WAMU in Washington, D.C., and he wants to know how much an iPhone would cost if it were made entirely in the United States. So we sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith, also an iPhone owner, to check it out.
Considering that the iPhone costs a fair amount of money, it sure doesn't like to talk about money. Siri, how much is an iPhone?
I hope you find me priceless, Stacey.
Well, being able to play Candy Crush during a subway delay is kind of priceless. And for the privilege, you'll pay between $650 and $850, depending on how much memory you want your iPhone to have. iPhones are mostly manufactured and assembled in China, famously by the company Foxconn.
It largely costs more to manufacture products in the United States because of higher labor costs.
Carl Howe is the vice president of data sciences at the Yankee Group.
Labor costs here are somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 3 times what they're going to be in China.
Right now, Apple pays around $5 per iPhone for assembly and labor. Moving that stateside would add around $10 to the cost of an iPhone. That would move the cost of the cheapest iPhone to about $660. But labor's not the most significant financial advantage to manufacturing the iPhone in China. Siri, how much do you cost?
I strive to be invaluable.
Rene Ritchie is the editor-in-chief of iMore, a publication about Apple products. He says Apple has been able to create whole iPhone assembling villages in China, and the convenience and efficiency of that system is difficult to price.
They have these special regions like Shenzhen, which is an industrial region in it. So if you need something fixed, you need something changed, it's just a couple buildings away. And that ability to keep everything so close together has incredible logistic advantages for Apple.
Ritchie says it would be almost impossible to recreate that system in the U.S., and that would mean a longer assembly time, a less efficient assembly, and lots of micro-shipments.
It's an incredibly complicated process to build one of these devices, and you'd have to move that entire culture of production to the U.S. in order for it to work.
And then there are the parts themselves. Andrew Rassweiler is with IHS Technology.
For almost every component that goes into the device, there may be as many as 2 or 3 sources. And then if you were to dig down another layer into some of the components, like the display, the touchscreen, the batteries, those are also assemblies that are comprised of multiple components coming from potentially multiple countries.
IHS broke down the cost of the iPhone's components and found they add up to around $190 per phone. The most expensive part of the iPhone is the display, which costs about $40. Making the display in the U.S. would roughly triple its cost, says Rassweiler. That alone would add around $80 to the cost of the iPhone, which brings the price of our iPhone to $740. Siri, how much do you cost?
I'm a pearl beyond price, Stacy.
Rassweiler says making all of the iPhone's parts in the U.S. would push the price of the iPhone's components from about $190 to about $600.
If the materials alone are costing $600, it stands to reason that that same iPhone could cost $2,000 at retail.
$2,000? That is a lot of money for an iPhone.
It is a lot of money for an iPhone. And I would say that trying to move Apple's entire supply chain is not just prohibitively expensive, but it's also impractical and not realistic.
And it wouldn't even earn political goodwill from most of its customers, says the Yankee Group's Carl Howe.
2 out of 3 Apple customers aren't in the USA anymore. That's quite a change from many years ago where most of the customers for Apple products were in the U.S.
It's just as well, says Howe. Even with all of the overseas cost efficiencies, the iPhone is still one of the most expensive phones around. Siri, you cost a lot.
Is that so?
Well, yes, it is, but it's still roughly 1/3 of what an all-American iPhone would cost. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You can find Dairy Queen stores in suburbs all over this country. You can find them in farthest China. Manhattan? Well, not yet, but soon. Dan Bobkoff reports.
John Gaynor is the mustachioed CEO of Minnesota-based International Dairy Queen. He sounds Midwest nice, even when he's in New York.
I like to say a blizzard is going to hit Manhattan and really New York City as a whole.
The blizzard is the chain's signature milkshake. Gaynor was in town taking a look at the soon-to-open two-story Dairy Queen on 14th Street in Manhattan. But this is a city with endless options for treats, including Dairy Queen's homegrown nightmare. I found a Mr. Softy truck nearby in Union Square, and Rick Perez inside didn't feel the threat.
People prefer Mr. Softy. Yes, it is New York thing.
Actually, CEO Gaynor says his competition is any fast food restaurant. McDonald's has a McFlurry, and this Dairy Queen serves burgers. And for all the talk of chains like 7-Eleven and IHOP and now Dairy Queen invading Manhattan, this one seems different.
New Yorkers have been very welcoming to our brand.
That's not just CEO talk. Many New Yorkers aren't from here, and like Adam Sansone, have nostalgia from growing up in Dairy Queen towns.
Actually, yeah, when we were younger, we'd ride our bikes there and stuff like that.
More Dairy Queens are on the way. Michael Moynihan of the city's Economic Development Corporation says they won't necessarily replace mom-and-pop shops. Retail in New York is expanding, thanks to less crime and a bigger population.
A lot of companies probably feel they can't afford not to be here in New York City.
In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Coming up, this is a guy who not only stepped back to square one, but then he stepped out of the square.
Our story on the rebirth of American industrial design continues, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 137 points today, 0.8%, finished at 16,374. The NASDAQ off 28 points, 0.7%, 4,096. The S&P 500 backed off 12 points, 0.6%, finished at 1,872. The markets today were no place for retailers. Sellers took a bat to Dick's Sporting Goods, beating down its shares 18%. Why? You ask, didn't they use a golf club? Well, that's part of the problem. At Dick's, sales at its Golf Galaxy stores were down 10% in the first quarter. Hunting-related sales were off as well. Staples shares were shredded 12.5% after the office supply store issued a disappointing earnings forecast. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Committee on Finance will hold a hearing about strengthening Social Security, brought to you by the letters U.S. and O. Sesame Street's Elmo and friends will roll onto Capitol Hill in their tour bus to attend the biannual USO Service Project event. Thinking about a dinner date? Keep in mind that it's National Waitstaff Day. Win over your server and your date with a large tip. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This, I know, will ring just a little bit hollow, coming as it does from a guy wearing blue jeans, but we just don't dress as well as we used to back in the day. And I'm talking way back here, too, the 1930s, which was, despite the Great Depression, the height of innovation in fashion and design. That's the subject of a new book called Elegance in an Age of Crisis, co-edited by Patricia Meir. She is the deputy director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. Patricia, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You are the subject matter expert on this one, so I will grant your thesis that the 30s were the time when modern clothing came to pass. But why? What happened?
It's an interesting confluence of a whole lot of events. First of all, it sat right after, very closely after World War I, which is a huge revolutionary period that really upended culture and society. Also, there was a lot of technical innovation going on in things related to clothing, mainly with textiles. And then I think also a sort of creative spirit amongst those in the fashion industry, wanting to keep their companies going, keep their employees going. And even for the poorest people, there was a really strong effort to try and dress well. Even if you only had one shirt, you would have that shirt perfect.
We will talk mostly, I imagine, about women in this interview because that's what the book is. But I want to start with the men and Fred Astaire. There, you can never get enough Fred Astaire. And there's a great picture of him. I think he's, getting off an airplane or something. And you look at the trousers. They are high-waisted. You look at the coat is a little looser. You know, I mean, it was a very distinct 1930s look.
Absolutely. And he really was called the modern man. And the brilliant thing about the Hollywood stars, the men in particular, is that they drove their own look. Women were costumed. clothes were made in studios, but the men went and got bespoke tailored clothing. And Fred Astaire was a great client of firms like Anderson and Shepard. He would dance up and down the hallways to make sure that they fit properly. So the fact that he was a dancer and that movement was so important, and that also he was on the big screen, he understood the importance of a properly proportioned garment, I think was one of the reasons why his style has such resonance today and why there is such an incredible level of ease about the way he dressed.
It does, I will confess, make me want to go out and spend a whole bunch of money on clothes and start wearing nicer clothes. But then I remember I'm in radio and it sort of doesn't matter. So, you know. There are all kinds of designer names in this book, as you would expect be. But there's one that I had never heard before. And I wanted to ask you why, because she's a little bit all over this book. Her name is Madeleine Vionnet. Who was she?
Many people consider her to be the greatest couturier of the 20th century. And in a certain way, shame on us, we fashion historians, because we haven't done a good enough job to put her properly in context. Vionnet was probably the most brilliant technician in modern fashion history. And she used geometry and mathematical calculations to create clothing that were so beautiful, balanced, and proportioned that she really created almost a new oeuvre or arm of cloth making.
Is it possible to say, or is it appropriate to say, that the Depression sort of helped the American apparel business, as it were? Because it's not like somebody who was out of a job was going to go to Paris for their clothing, right?
Yeah, and I think what it also helped was lead to certain types of creativity. For example, one of the greatest menswear magazines ever, Apparel Arts, was launched in 1931, first as a sales tool. But the magazine was so beautiful and influential, it eventually was sold to the general public and became Esquire magazine.
Oh.
So this concept of how to promote clothing, how to continue to be creative, was something that was really important. And the United States was already the great fashion machine, if you will. We were not as well known for artistic fashion, but many other areas we were so highly innovative in.
Patricia Mears is Deputy Director of the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. She is the co-editor with her colleague Bruce Boyer of a book called Elegance in an Age of Crisis Fashions of the 1930s. Thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
We're going to pick up now with David Weinberg's story from yesterday about two men who are trying to revitalize American industrial design. It's a story about craftsmanship and imagination and enterprise as well. They've set up a patronage system of sorts, and their first commission is a motorcycle called the Bienville Legacy. Here's David again.
David Lenk has spent his entire life surrounded by industrial design. His grandfather was at one point the largest manufacturer of soldering irons in the world. And he later attended the Rhode Island School of Design.
So I guess you could say I've sort of been born with this bug and have sort of nurtured it through my whole life.
Today, he designs museum exhibits for a living. After finishing a recent job in New Orleans, his employer took him to a French Quarter bar called Molly's. By chance, they happened to sit next to one of the most renowned motorcycle designers in the world, J.T. Nesbitt.
You know, it was a Motorhead moment, and within, I think, two sentences, we were talking about French coachwork of the 1930s, and the conversation ended with an invitation to visit his shop that Saturday. But nothing could have prepared me for, you know, what I saw there.
J.T.'s shop is called Bienville Studios. It's about a block from the Mississippi River on the edge of the French Quarter. When you step inside, it's surprising just how spare it is. A small workbench, a few racks with parts, some toolboxes. But the most striking thing in JT's shop is in the center of the room. It's a strange-looking motorcycle, balancing on a hydraulic lift like a statue on a pedestal. It's a prototype that JT built. He's named it the Bienville Legacy. When David Lenk saw it for the first time, he was so moved, he cried.
Yes, I did. And what I saw was a motorcycle that basically challenges many, many engineering precepts that go back 120 years. This is a guy who not only stepped back to square one, but then he stepped out of the square.
Let's go back to square one. The origin of the motorcycle is essentially a bicycle.
I mean, think about the first motorcycle. It was a bicycle that somebody hung an engine onto.
But with this motorcycle, the Bienville Legacy, JT started from an entirely new origin point, the bow.
The very first man-made spring is a bow and arrow. So this technology is like Paleolithic, man. It predates civilization.
Imagine a bow and arrow pointed at the sky. Where your hand grips the bow is where the engine of the motorcycle is attached. At each end of the bow is a wheel. So instead of having shocks like a regular motorcycle, the entire bike is one big leaf spring. It looks like it's part beast, part machine.
Well, there's no example, as far as I know, of anybody else in the world ever doing that. It is completely original thought.
Alan Cathcart has written about motorcycles for over 30 years. He's been called the Kingmaker because he's often the first person to ride and review new bikes. He described JT's design as breathtaking, though to most people, it simply looks strange.
It doesn't matter whether it's a strange-looking thing because we don't have to sell them.
If this were a typical corporate motorcycle, the plan would be to put this bike into production and sell them for a profit. But this is not a profit-driven endeavor.
To look at this for short-term recoupment would be to undermine the overall purpose of what we're up to.
That's Jim Jacoby. He's put up his life savings to pay for the building of three prototypes. Jim gave JT a blank check and told him to build his dream bike without any constraints. The expectation is that by allowing JT the freedom to experiment with new ideas and materials, breakthroughs in engineering and design will emerge. When I visited JT at his shop, one of the first things he showed me was a small box full of bolts.
What are these right here?
Man, this is titanium hardware that I actually designed.
These titanium bolts and other hardware alone cost $30,000. Boeing's prototype shop in Seattle is manufacturing them.
There's no motorcycle out there that uses this much titanium, this much carbon composite, structurally. I think that all motorcycle designers want to use those materials, but they're limited by their budgets. And now it's available. 10 years ago, I couldn't have done what I'm doing now because the military-industrial complex had sucked up all the titanium.
One of the byproducts of this motorcycle is 8 original engineering patents related to the suspension system, says Jim Jacoby.
The outcomes from the patents might be new ways of even doing suspension on automobiles.
This is one potential long-term source of revenue from the bike. If the automotive industry adopts these ideas, it would have to pay to license the patents. When JT was commissioned to build his motorcycle prototype, he signed over the patents and all the intellectual property to the ADMCI, the American Design and Mastercraft Initiative. In exchange, he was given total freedom and an unlimited budget for materials. And he gets his rent paid, but zero salary.
I think on balance, man, I'm coming out way ahead. I'm giving everything I can to live my dream. I get to reinvent American motorcycling.
The next step for JT and Jim is to prove that the motorcycle is more than just a beautifully crafted, groundbreaking machine, that it can perform. So they're taking the bike to the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah to attempt to break a world land speed record.
The weight advantage for a variety of the design decisions is tremendous. I mean, it's probably going to net out as a 350-pound bike with a 300 to 350-horsepower engine, which is, by any definition, a rocket.
And Jim has decided that he wants to be the one to ride the bike across the Salt. He'll have to top 200 miles per hour. He's never gone anywhere near that fast on a motorcycle, which he admits is absurd.
It's completely absurd.
But, he says, it's also necessary.
There are a variety of tenets that are crucial to taking on a commission, and one of them is proving that it's not just an art project. It's a design that is, as JT would put it, proven on the field of battle. And so the field of battle here is the Salt Flats.
After JT finishes building the motorcycles, he will remain a part of the ADMCI.
I become one of the people who's involved with selecting the next project.
He will get to help pick out the next master craftsman to get a blank check for their idea.
To go sit down with people and ask them the question, what would you do if you could do anything? And when somebody asks you, what would you do if you could do anything, you had better be ready with a good answer.
another good one from Marketplace's David Weinberg. The visuals on this story are pretty good, too. You can see the Bienville legacy and take a peek inside J.T. Nesbitt Studios at marketplace.org. This final note today, in which I tell you nothing you don't already know, but which seems topical nonetheless in light of the Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and AT&T DirecTV mergers. The American Customer Satisfaction Index is out with its latest survey of the telecommunications industry. And yes, you do, in fact, know where I'm going with this. Internet service providers and cable TV services are at the bottom of the bottom. ISPs get a satisfaction score of 63. That's out of 100. Cable companies got a 65. Doing surprisingly well, though, if you can call what is basically a C-plus well, are cell phone companies and wireless providers. And with that, we are out of here. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on a Tuesday. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.